Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students. The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves. WHFR.fm. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to whfr@hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Brianna LaMorgan from the Borneo Project about deforestation, palm oil, and threats to the indigenous communities of Borneo. We'll also talk with Avital Andrews from Sierra Magazine and get some tips for outings. And Annie Somerville, the executive chef of Green's Restaurant, will give us some green cuisine tips. We're here in our studio now with Brianna LaMorgan, who's the executive director of the Borneo Project. And we're going to talk today about some of the environmental challenges facing Borneo and some of the surprising ways that people in North America may actually be involved in some of those impacts. So welcome.
Thanks.
you know, I think something that our listeners might be interested in is a little bit about your background and how you came to be involved in environmental politics in Borneo. It's a place that a lot of people in the United States don't know much about or have never visited. So I'm curious how you first made that leap to work on their issues.
Yeah, it definitely is a place a lot of people have not heard about. I think it's good to even just say that, you know, it's Borneo is shared between Indonesia and Malaysia, between China and Australia. Sometimes that's sort of helpful for folks. But I actually moved to Borneo when I was 9 years old. My mom is a cultural anthropologist, and so she went to Borneo to do research on the sort of tales and the songs of the indigenous communities, particularly the Kayan community in Indonesian Borneo. And so she brought me with her. And our plan was to stay for 1 year. And she liked it so much, and I was doing so well there, we stayed for 7 years.
Wow.
So you
went to high school there?
I went to between 3rd and 10th grade there. And I went to local schools. So when I was first in Borneo, it was really just a beautiful place. I mean, we were living in small villages upriver. These were rivers that were still really just clear and gorgeous, and people were hunting and they were doing small-scale Swidden farming, and they had small gardens in the villages, and it was just a really great, beautiful place to grow up. And then after I finished university, I went back to the same villages, and it was a really sort of sobering trip. It was a trip where I saw that the place where these communities used to farm has now been clear-cut for palm oil plantations, and the rivers that folks used to fish in and use for water, now there were no more fish left in it because the runoff from palm oil plantations, sort of the toxic pesticides, had gotten into the water, and you couldn't fish in it anymore. And communities, because they couldn't make a livelihood in their village, people were moving to the cities, and the villages themselves were really desolate and sort of, I mean, I knew that this was happening, and I knew that these were issues that were important to me as someone who'd grown up there, but being able to sort of see that and to see the impact that these plantations were having sort of started me on this career path of working on these issues.
And so let's talk about palm oil, because this was something that I found very surprising when I first learned about it. What exactly is it? What are these plantations like, and what are some of the problems around it?
So palm oil there's more palm oil traded than any other kind of vegetable oil in the world by volume. And 98% of that comes from Indonesia and Malaysia. Mostly it's going to China and India as frying oil, and it's used as a lubricant for industrial machinery, things like that. It also goes to Europe as a biofuel. And it also about
biofuel meaning like to burn for cars?
Yeah, to burn for cars. It's become less and less viable. There was a period about 4 or 5 years ago where there was a huge scare that was going to become the new quote-unquote sustainable fuel, which it most definitely isn't. We seem to have gotten past sort of the crisis moment around that, and it's sort of lost its viability. Nonetheless, it's still a possibility as the price of petroleum goes up that people might start to reconsider palm oil as a biofuel. So palm oil plantations are monocrop plantations. Palm oil is originally from Africa, so it grows really well in tropical regions. It grows great in Borneo. So what you have to do to make a palm oil plantation is you have to clear cut the rainforest. In the best place to grow palm oil is in peat swamps. And peat swamps are the most carbon-rich kind of soil in the world. But they're a swamp. So what you have to do is after you clear cut the trees on it, you have to drain it. And then once you drain it, you have to burn it. And so burning this carbon-rich soil has made Indonesia into the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world after China and the U.S. So you have this scorched earth, literally, and then you plant your monocrop plantation on it. And I think everyone sort of knows that tropical rainforests are just incredibly diverse places, you know, thousands upon thousands of different species in a single acre. In palm oil plantations, you get palm oil trees, pigs, bats, and snakes. Those are the only things that live in a palm oil plantation. And occasionally you'll get an animal like an orangutan, like an incredible endangered species that no longer has enough habitat to live in the actual forest. And so they're forced into palm oil plantations because they can sort of eat the fruit, or they're looking for food that they can eat, but they really can't survive there.
So where does palm oil actually come from? What is it in the plant that's being turned into oil?
So the seed of it is what gets turned into oil. Basically, palm oil fruit, people sometimes get confused because they think palm, they think coconut palm, but palm oil fruit actually sort of looks like a gigantic cluster of grapes, except that it weighs about 50 kilos and is about 3 feet long. So there's a lot of different seeds on one palm oil fruit, and the oil comes from the meat of the fruit itself, and then a different kind of oil comes from the nut of the fruit.
So it's a completely different kind of palm tree from a date palm or a coconut palm.
Yeah, I mean, they're related, but you would never mistake them if you looked at them.
What does this mean for the indigenous folks who you work with in Borneo?
Well, I mean, it comes back down to the fundamental issues of land rights and sort of their human right to be able to farm and to make use of their land. Both in Indonesia and Malaysia, the two countries that share Borneo, communities do not have legal rights to their land before they go through an extremely complicated legal process. It's a different process in both countries, but in both places, the vast majority of indigenous communities do not have legal rights to their land. So what this means is that the government is the default owner of any land that's not otherwise sort of specified. And so when a palm oil plantation company comes in and goes to the government and says, we want to build a palm oil plantation, they can look at a map and they can say, oh, well, none of this land is owned. We'll just sell this to you. So they'll look at a map in a city somewhere and they'll give that land to the palm oil company.
Even though there's people living on it, farming on it.
Exactly.
And then an outside company can just come in and scorch the earth?
Absolutely. So what happens is people learn that their land has been sold, land that they've always thought of theirs because they've lived on it and worked on it for generations upon generations. They'll learn that it's been sold when a company representative comes in with a bulldozer and says, we own this land. It's too bad that you have a farm on it. It's too bad that your house is on it. It's ours now, and we're going to bulldoze it. And so there are countless examples of communities learning that their land has been sold by being kicked off of it.
What does the Borneo Project do to help these communities?
So we do a variety of different things. Sort of the fundamental thing that we do is help communities get legal rights to this land. So the Borneo Project has traditionally focused on Malaysian Borneo, which is the northern part of the island. And we work there with a series of different lawyers who are addressing land rights issues and working directly with communities to help them get legal rights to their land. So the first thing that we do is we run mapping workshops and help communities map their land, because you need to have these maps in order to take your case to court. And then after you map the land, we provide small grant funding for communities to be able to travel to the city, to be able to afford hotels, to be able to get food while they're fighting their case. The lawyers do their work pro bono, but we're also able to provide small stipends for the lawyers when they're not actually able to cover all of their expenses.
Do the indigenous groups there speak different languages than the main language of government there?
They all speak their own indigenous language. There's thousands of different languages that are found on the, well, hundreds, sorry, of different languages that are found on the island. But most people speak some Malay. Mm-hmm. So you'll find folks that have gone through school or folks that are a little bit more, have spent more time trading or in the cities, will speak Malay. And that's actually one of the other projects that we run, is we run an indigenous schools program so that indigenous kids can learn. First, they can learn to read and write in their traditional language, which is something that when they're sent to elementary school, all the classes are taught in Malay, and these kids often fail out because they do not speak Malay. Mm-hmm. So we have indigenous language preschools in three different communities that teach kids both how to get along in Malay, but also teach them these basic skills in their traditional language that helps them then support the other members of their communities who are doing things like fighting for their land rights.
Back to the palm oil issue, you mentioned biofuels in Europe. You mentioned the oil being used to fry, meals and foods in Asia. What about North America? How is palm oil connected to the United States in any way?
Right. So estimates of how much palm oil come into the United States are somewhere between 5 to 10% of the global supply, depending on the year and exactly how the markets are flowing. So we actually get relatively little palm oil compared to the international market. Mm-hmm. Our most direct connection is through our agribusiness companies. So companies like Cargill and like Archer Daniels Midland are companies that are involved in the trading and the production of palm oil and who own palm oil plantations in those countries. So sort of some of our corporate giants are the ones that are sort of driving this expansion.
Is there any way to do palm oil right? Is the goal to fix the way palm oil is grown, or is it to eliminate the use of palm oil and switch to more sustainable oils?
There are better ways of growing palm oil, and there are worse ways of growing palm oil. Right now, the vast majority of palm oil is grown in an incredibly unsustainable way, like I was talking about. It is possible to grow palm oil on land that is already degraded, in land that is owned by the communities, in land where you can have cooperatives to process that palm oil, and when it can be sold at a small scale, more fair trade model, it is possible. There are very few models of where that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So the goal is not necessarily to say that we should never have palm oil ever again in the world and we should just cut it out. The goal is to say that you need to respect people's rights. You need to actually respect the environment and not burn peat swamps or cut down forests to make palm oil. And you need to respect the rights of the producers and the people who are working on the palm oil plantation and enable them to actually make a sustainable livelihood off of the palm oil plantation instead of having them work for incredibly impossible to survive on wages.
I've heard that one of the uses for palm oil is in a lot of beauty products that are sold in the U.S. Is that true? And if so, I mean, how can people know? Is it listed on the ingredients as palm oil? Does it go by other names?
It goes by other names. And so what I would say is a huge number of beauty products in the United States do contain palm oil. It's a tiny amount of palm oil. So I think it's great to sort of draw awareness and attention to it as a way that palm oil is sort of part of our everyday lives. But in the overall scheme of things, it's tiny. It's generally marked on the packages as palmitate or vitamin A palmitate. And so if you're looking to avoid it, that's sort of the wording you would look for.
Well, I think it's just interesting that there is a connection. I mean, I think a lot of people would be really surprised and upset to know that their hand cream or their lotion or whatever is actually contributing to, you know, some of the things you've talked about, scorched earth in Indonesia, huge amounts of global warming pollution, you know, indigenous displacement off their land for indigenous communities. I guess, you know, it might not be a huge percentage of the palm oil internationally, but what can people in North America, what can our listeners do to help with this? If it's not searching their beauty products and making sure they don't buy it, I mean, what else can they do that's actually going to make a real impact in the lives of the communities that you work with?
I mean, I definitely don't mean to say that just because it's a small quantity, we should just accept it and just move on with it.
Sure.
I think avoiding palm oil is an important step. And I think educating people that, you know, that in your day-to-day life, that what they're eating and what they're drinking, like, has, you know, has a direct connection to rainforest destruction is incredibly important. I guess there's a lot of different things you can do. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can do is there's campaigns here in the United States, including from the Borneo Project and other organizations that work on putting pressure on some of the agribusiness companies in the United States, the Archer Daniels Midlands and Cargill. So taking action against those guys is really important. What the Borneo Project focuses on is actually focusing more directly on the driving forces and the way that this is impacting the communities directly. And so we're focused on supporting those communities so that they can get rights to their land and so that they can make the decision about whether or not they even want to have palm oil on their land in the first place. Because once they have the right to make that decision, they have a say over who they sell their palm oil to, if they choose to grow palm oil or if they want to sustain or conserve their land. I would also say that although it may not feel as directly connected to our everyday lives, speaking up for the rights of those communities, and we have some ongoing campaigns on our website, borneoproject.org, to support the specific communities who are fighting for their land rights and fighting to be able to make a long-term sustainable livelihood for themselves is also really important.
What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about Borneo, or what is it that people need to know about Borneo in order to understand some of the subtleties of this work?
I mean, I think the fundamental thing that people think about Borneo, the fact that it's the third largest island in the world, that it's home to just incredible biodiversity, It's home to indigenous communities that are strong and very connected to their forest home is all really true. But I think people don't really understand what the main threats are to Borneo right now. I mean, logging for the sake of tropical hardwoods is important, but really right now the driving factors for deforestation are palm oil expansion. They're the expansion of mega dams that are displacing, they're drowning out hundreds of thousands of acres of forests and displacing thousands of communities. And they're also the corruption that is just omnipresent, in particularly in the Malaysian government, where the chief minister of the province of Sarawak has been in power for 30 years and who is profiting directly from the building of dams, from the building of roads, and from the expansion of plantations.
From your recent trips to Borneo, are there any stories of hope that you have to share with us? I mean, are you optimistic mm-hmm. about what the future holds?
You know, I am, or else I couldn't do this work. One of the best examples that I think has happened recently is there has been incredible work from indigenous communities and from small organizations in Borneo fighting the expansion of dams. So in August of last year, the Borneo Project supported a gathering of indigenous leaders from across Borneo, 150 indigenous leaders who are living in areas that would be drowned out by dams, came together in the town of Miri in Sarawak. And they came together to say that they're going to stop these 12 new dams that are coming in. And so they formed a new organization, Save Rivers Sarawak. And Save Rivers has been doing community education. They've been going longhouse to longhouse. People traditionally live in longhouses and not villages. Doing screenings of a short movie that was made about another dam that has been built and sort of talking about the impacts, organizing the community, organizing protest trips to the different longhouses. And so one of the things that we're doing is helping provide international solidarity for their anti-dam campaign, bringing awareness about what the issues are in Borneo to a U.S. audience, and getting both funding support for them and sort of campaigns and sign-on letters to the decision makers who are really the decision makers who can stop the dams in Borneo.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Brihanna La Morgan, who's the executive director of the Borneo Project. And you can find out more on their website at borneoproject.org. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living editor at Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
It's always good to have you back on the show. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about Sierra Club outings. I know that some of our listeners might be interested, but if you're looking for ways to get outdoors, there are a lot of options that the Sierra Club offers.
Yes, outdoors and all over the country and all over the world. If you've got the travel bug and are a big fan of the Sierra Club, then the outings department is where you want to look.
Now, talk to us a little bit about the history, because I know that this started back in the very origins of the Sierra Club in the 1890s, right?
Yeah, absolutely. John Muir was the founder of the Sierra Club, as most of our listeners know. But he believed strongly that if he brought people outdoors and if he took people into these great places, that they'd fall in love with our country's wild places and they'd start to feel a responsibility to protect them. So he wanted to inspire conservationism through love for a destination. So,
and I think that's certainly true for anyone who's actually been to the Grand Canyon and seen what it looks like. You're not going to want to let them go ahead and do uranium mining in the Grand Canyon as they've been proposing recently. I mean, I think that people who experience those places do feel more motivated to protect them.
Exactly. I think for me, at least, any place that has sort of elicited goosebumps on me, I'm never going to want to see desecrated.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about where these outings are? How many of them are there? What kind of destinations?
They are literally everywhere. They're all over the world, Africa, Asia, all over America, Europe. They're just, you know, spin the globe, point your finger, and if it's not in the middle of the ocean, Sierra Club outings will go there. And they always have great expert guides leading them. A lot of times they're actually just volunteers who are really passionate about the place leading tourists and travelers to that specific place.
Now, I know that some people may have some questions about how eco-friendly it is to fly far away to go on vacation, because obviously there's impact there. But I do know that the trips at least do follow environmentally friendly guidelines. So once you get to your destination, you do know that it's going to be definitely an eco-friendly trip. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, the trips do follow strict guidelines to minimize impact. Anything that the Sierra Club endorses, these trips will do to again, minimize their impact. I am fairly sure that they offset, and they're all environmentally friendly outdoor activities. So, yes, once you get there, there's rarely a trip in a car. A lot of it is hiking. A lot of it is on foot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the philosophy is that, yes, there's a cost to get people to these places, and there is airfare and fuel involved, but the greater good is served by, again, eliciting the love for these places and these people, so that small amount of fuel or carbon that was emitted gets offset by that person then loving that place and becoming a voter to protect that place.
And an advocate.
And an advocate, exactly.
So what special interest trips are available?
So we have some service trips and volunteer vacations that people can, if they have a pet cause that they want to contribute to, if they want to clear trails, or if they want to release sea turtles, they can sign up for that exact type of vacation. And there are also family trips that you can get kids passionate about these places and issues, women's trips, beginners trips. There's all kinds of specialties available.
And where do people go for more information or to see the full list of trips?
sierraclub.org, and you'll click on outings.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
Thanks, Harley.
Joining us now in our studio is Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
For those of you who tune in every week, you know by now that Annie joins us and talks with us about different vegetables and fruits, produce, what's in season, and what you can cook with it. Now, we thought it would be a good time today, Annie, to talk about how people can make their own vegetable stock at home, which is also greener because then you don't have to buy it in a can or a carton, and you can save the waste of the extra packaging. So how can people go about making vegetable stock simply at home to use in some of these cooking recipes?
Well, I'm a big advocate of making stocks because we at Greens, we are producing so many vegetable scraps every moment of the day. And also, I find that the packaged stocks can be salty. And so I'm a big advocate of just bringing out the flavor of the vegetables in the stock and not having salt be an overriding flavor. So I would say there are a few rules for stock making. And other than that, it's quite simple. But rule number one is be sure to use vegetables that are reasonably fresh. You don't want to use it as your you don't want to take anything and put it in your stock that should be going into your compost or your worm bin.
I'm probably guilty of doing that. Maybe that's why my stock isn't turning
out so
well. But
there are, you know, there's some flexibility there. So you be your own best judge there. And then the other is, unless you're making a broccoli soup or a cauliflower soup or a cabbage soup, I recommend staying away from the members of the brassicas family because they can be very overpowering. But if you
For our listeners who don't know the terminology, the brassica family is
broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, all those yummy vegetables that are pretty, pretty strong. So, and can be overpowering. For instance, if you were making like a delicate brothy soup, you wouldn't want to use them. And then what else? I think it's good to just, you know, have kind of ratio, just a rough ratio would be to use maybe for if you want your yield to be about 2 quarts of stock. And I will also say if you're going to make stock, go ahead and make a double batch and use half of it right away or in the next day or two and put the other half in the freezer. And then that way, the next time you're feeling like making soup, but feeling like you just can't quite get it together, don't do the whole thing and just pull the stock out of the freezer.
Okay, so going back to how you actually make the stock, mm-hmm. You take a whole bunch of vegetables.
Yes, and so I would say a couple of onions. If you happen to have a leek, the leek tops are great. A few cloves of garlic. You don't have to peel them. You can just smash them with the side of your knife, leave the skins on. Maybe a couple of carrots. A potato or two, you can just scrub them. You don't need to peel them. Cut those into big chunks. What else?
Maybe some
mushrooms.
Celery.
Yes, celery, definitely. And celery, maybe a few stalks, but not too much because that can be a little overpowering. And then you can kind of take it from there. For instance, if you're making a squash soup, then you can use the skin and the seeds from squash. Or if you're making a broccoli soup, include some of those broccoli trimmings. So I also add sprigs of fresh herbs, if they're available, a couple of bay leaves. So in this case, like here we are in sunny California, I would add some thyme sprigs, some parsley, some sage leaves, maybe some marjoram oregano, some salt. Salt helps to not only draw out flavor, but also it's a chemical process. It begins to break down the vegetables, so it, they release their kind of breaks down the cell walls of the vegetables. And then a few peppercorns, and then cover that maybe with 10 cups of water, and then put it in a big, well, put that whole deal in a big pot, and then bring it to a boil, lower it to a simmer, and maybe cook it for about 45 minutes, not much longer, because really at that point in time, you've gotten everything you can out of the vegetables. And then pour it through a strainer or a colander, and then just press it with whatever utensil you like to press with, just to get a lot of the juice out of the vegetables. Set it aside to cool, and there you have it.
And put the vegetable scraps in your compost.
Put those vegetable scraps in the compost. And I can also say, if you want a more browner, more golden stock, you can start by sautéing your onions and garlic in a little bit of olive oil or a canola oil, something you like to cook with. And that will kind of give it a kind of deeper, richer flavor. But it's really not necessary, so it's up to you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Annie Somerville, the executive chef at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Stitcher, offering the Stitcher mobile app with the latest episodes of Freakonomics and thousands of podcasts based on Stitcher's customized recommendations. Available in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/freak. Support also comes from Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
Oh, look at the artichoke. Aren't those beautiful, Wendy?
This is the Camino Real Farmers Market in Goleta, California. It's in Santa Barbara County, about 100 miles northwest of Los Angeles. The produce is bountiful and it's local.
You use that on ribs?
Yeah, so good.
We've got lettuce and greens and chard and leeks and fennel and turnips and artichokes and spinach and cabbage and broccoli and about everything else that you can get your hands on this time of year. Our farm is about 2 miles away from where we're selling right now, the farmer's market.
And it's just amazing. Yeah.
Santa Barbara County has a lot going for it. The beach, the University of California, Santa Barbara, and farming. It is in the top 1% of agriculture-producing counties in the U.S., about $1.2 billion worth a year. Now, imagine for a moment that everything is interrupted by some kind of a natural disaster.
In 2005, there was a mudslide at La Conchita, which is a community in the southeastern part of Santa Barbara County, right on the coast.
That's David Cleveland. He teaches environmental studies at UC Santa Barbara. The mudslide he's talking about killed 10 people.
And also blocked off the 101 freeway and the railroad, which are the main transportation connections with Los Angeles. And these transportation links were closed for at least a week.
So Santa Barbara couldn't ship its produce down to the distribution centers in L.A. or anywhere else, nor could it ship produce in. But that wouldn't seem to be a problem, since Santa Barbara grows so much. You'd think that the grocery stores would still have plenty of fruits and veg.
So we had produce sections that were empty, and here's farmers with boxes of harvested fruit and vegetables that their distributors can't pick them up. Mm-hmm. So farmers, we went and talked to the produce manager at this grocery chain, and we said, look, we got stuff we can't get out, and you can't get anything in. Let's make a deal. And they were told, no, sorry, we got a contract.
Did you feel it was absurd or more along the lines of borderline criminal?
Well, often does two things go together, I guess.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today, the second episode of our two-part podcast, You Eat What You Are. Last time out, we heard from the food-obsessed economist Tyler Cowen.
There's another kind of food snob where everything has to be like a farmer's market. Everything has to be sustainable. Everything has to be in some way modest or geared down or hippie-like.
And from food philosophers Michael Pollan and Alice Waters.
You know, one of the things we need to do in this country is raise the prestige of farming and recognize the work that good farmers do, which is really important to us. We depend on them, and yet they're, for most of us, totally anonymous.
I do really believe that. I think that the work of the farmer, it needs to be elevated to a very important and vital place.
And so today, we try to find out, is going local the way to go? That's why we're starting in Santa Barbara County, which, it turns out, is a pretty good microcosm for just how complicated or just how messed up our food network is. Here you've got a place that grows more than $1 billion worth of food a year. But, as you just heard, when transportation is cut off for a week, the produce sections at grocery stores start to empty out. Isn't that bizarre? You'd think, with all that local produce, that Santa Barbara would be the epicenter of the local food movement. So what's going on here? David Cleveland, the UC Santa Barbara professor, he decided to find out.
Time Magazine, I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, the cover of Time Magazine was local, the new organic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of... One of my students brought that in and said, hey, have you seen this? And I said, no, I haven't seen that. Because I've been teaching a class in world agriculture for the last 10 or 15 years at UCSB. And localization hasn't been an explicit part of what we talked about. And you know, I just realized that this was being promoted as a remedy for a lot of the problems that many people saw with the mainstream food system.
And when you see this being promoted as a remedy or maybe even a panacea, it sounds like you're saying,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first reaction to that then? Was it like, yeah, this is what we need, or, uh-oh, this might not be the right prescription? Or, I don't know, a combination?
It was a combination because, you know, I have an emotional – it's emotionally appealing, the idea of, yeah, local food going to the farmer's
sure.
market and,
yeah.
and, you know, all the stuff that goes with that. And at the same time, my academic background was saying, well, how do we really know if this is working?
Mm-hmm.
And we're all familiar with the concept of greenwash and self-delusion and, you know, misplaced assumptions. And so I immediately said, well, gosh, I wonder, we should really see how local the Santa Barbara County food system already is, because we have thriving farmers markets. CSAs are growing like gangbusters, and restaurants are advertising their local food, and the UCSB dining, residential dining, is a major program to get more local food. And so I said, well, gosh, let's just see how local we are.
So how did you come to this? Did you come, were you interested? Did you grow up on a farm? Did you grow up thinking and knowing a lot about agriculture? Or did you come from the environmental side? Were you an environmentalist who wanted to get into the science of it?
I came from the food side.
Meaning
I did.
You eat? Meaning what does that mean?
Well,
the food side?
meaning I've always been interested in food. It's always been my early years were on a farm, and I've always been interested in eating good food. You know, like a person who always reads the labels when they buy stuff.
Yeah.
So that kind of interest, and then I guess that coincided with an interest in the bigger picture of the environment and population and how do we deal with this stuff. When I did my dissertation research in Ghana, West Africa, in the northeast part of the country, and it was during one of the major drought periods, and both years I was there was a major famine, and I would lie in my little mud hut at night thinking, why are people in this part of the world struggling? We're working hard. They're smart people who work hard all day long, and yet they're going hungry. And then there's other people in other parts of the world who don't know nearly as much about how to grow food and don't work as hard, and they have too much food. And just, you know, thinking about those issues kind of drove my interest in understanding agri-food systems.
So, David, I'm curious, can you just describe kind of, you know, your drive from home to the university? What do you pass? Are you passing strawberry fields and almond groves, or what's it look like?
Well, actually, I ride my bike to campus. It's only about 5.5 miles, so, and I live on the coastal bike path, so it's very nice, but I pass organic farms on the way. Actually, yesterday when I biked into campus, there were strawberries ripening on their plastic mulch, and fava beans growing, and I could smell the compost and manure.
So you're describing what to me, at least over the wire, sounds kind of like a locavore nirvana. You're talking about these restaurants, and even the university dining hall, you know, advertises its local food, and you bike to work through the lovely, alternatingly sweet and pungent smells of strawberries and manure. And so, so you must be, you know, from what you're telling me so far, I would think you're living at, like, you know, ground zero locavore central. Was that your assumption as well?
Yeah. It was like, wow, this is so, let's just see how. What we're really doing, because certainly the potential's there, because I knew before we started the research that Santa Barbara was producing somewhere around 2.3 billion pounds of fruits and vegetables a year.
So David Cleveland, along with about 10 students, worked for a year to track that 2.3 billion pounds of produce, specifically to see how much of it was being exported and how much was being consumed locally.
This is what really shocked us, was that we found that when you added up all these different ways in which locally grown produce got to people in Santa Barbara County, we found that less than 5% of the fruits and vegetables consumed in Santa Barbara County were actually grown in Santa Barbara County, and the other 95% were imported.
It's hard to even understand how that could come to pass. I mean, even if one believes in the ultimate efficiency of the most efficient markets, you're growing the stuff right there, and then people are eating it right there, but the stuff that they're eating is not the stuff that they're growing? I don't even get it.
I don't either. Yeah, this is something that part of it is it's the way the market is structured.
Now, you're not an economist. You're an environmental scientist,
no.
Correct?
I'm an anthropologist.
Okay, so because you're not an economist, I'm guessing, and forgive me, I really am just guessing, I'm guessing you're thinking, well, if this is the way the economy works in this case, then it's dumb. It doesn't make sense, right, to take food that we grow locally here, ship it off to a warehouse, and then ship it back to here. So you know what? In some twisted configuration of incentives, that has come to pass, but it's stupid. Was that your thought?
Yeah, and my thought was that somehow this economic system, people are being rewarded economically for this kind of behavior, one assumes, but somehow the reward system for economic behavior is totally out of sync with the reward system for good nutrition, for community, for environment. There's this disconnect between economics and the reason that we grow food.
What Cleveland is saying certainly seems to make sense, that when it comes to food, the modern economy conspires against three very important factors: good nutrition, the environment, and community, meaning local farmers and the people who support them. But Cleveland's research was showing something different. We'll start with the local farmers. It looked as if things were working out okay for them. Why else would they sell most of their produce for export rather than keep it local? What about the nutrition? Here's another surprising fact that Cleveland found. A 100% local diet wouldn't improve nutrition within the county. Higher income might, but a a dearth of local produce wasn't the problem. Still, what about the environment? As David Cleveland puts it, most of what's grown in Santa Barbara is shipped out, and most of what's eaten in Santa Barbara is shipped in. This seems crazy, he says. Surely, that is crazy, isn't it? Coming up, the math behind carbon emissions and local food. When your eyes saw that number, what did you think?
We went back and redid our calculations.
And is there a moral upside to not eating local food?
I just keep coming back to feeling a certain amount of satisfaction that I'm eating grapes that are keeping up the standard of living in Chile.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. Get the latest episodes of Freakonomics, NPR, This American Life, and other shows on your mobile phone or tablet. Over 6,000 podcasts are available based on Stitcher's customized recommendations. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes to your mobile phone. The Stitcher mobile app is in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/freak.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Okay, so David Cleveland, who teaches environmental studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that 95% of the produce consumed in Santa Barbara County, which grows $1.2 billion worth a year, is imported, some of it from the other side of the world, whereas 99% of the produce grown there is exported. Now that sounds, on the surface, like an environmental travesty. So he began looking into those numbers too. What would happen, for instance, if Santa Barbara County went totally locavore? If all the produce eaten in Santa Barbara were also grown there?
Yeah, we wanted to look at what effect 100% localization of the Santa Barbara County food system, which is a physically, biologically very feasible thing to do because, you know, could have the land, we were growing so much and so forth. So what if we did 100% localize the system? What effect would that have on greenhouse gas emissions? And we found that it wouldn't make a lot of difference. Our savings in greenhouse gas emissions per household as a proportion of the total food system greenhouse gas emissions was less than 1%.
Wow. When your eyes saw that number, what did you think?
We went back and redid our calculations.
I don't blame you. You thought, how can this possibly be true?
Right. And so, you know, it wasn't we didn't think it was going to be a huge number, but we were still a bit surprised that it was less than 1%. And when you look at that in terms of what the EPA estimated, for example, in 2008 for greenhouse gas emissions per person in the United States in 2008, it's 0.1%. So I guess the point that we began to dawn on me and the others was that even though our food system accounts for a huge amount of our impact on the environment, including greenhouse gas emissions, and localization is being promoted as a major cure to all that's wrong with our current food system, in terms of one of the focal impacts, it doesn't necessarily have a great deal of effect.
How can this be? As Cleveland says, producing food requires a lot of energy, so wouldn't it make sense that we could use a lot less energy by transporting food shorter distances?
Well, I mean, the take-home message that we learned is that basically transportation is really only about 7% of the greenhouse gas footprint associated with the overall average American diet.
That's Christopher Weber. He's a researcher at the Science and Technology Policy Institute in Washington. Back in 2008, he and a colleague, H. Scott Matthews, analyzed the U.S. food network and found that the energy used in the transportation of food represents a relatively trivial amount of the overall energy used. Their paper made a bit of noise. So this paper that you wrote, I understand that you've said that no matter what you do for the – you're a young guy, right? You're in your
– Relatively, sure.
Early 30s, maybe mid-30s?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And so you've got a long career ahead of you, and I've heard you say that no matter what you do, unless maybe barring a Nobel or Pulitzer Prize, that what's going to be on your gravestone is this paper that you wrote as your graduate thesis, yes?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way.
One person who found the Weber-Matthews research interesting was Ed Glaser. He's an economist at Harvard who spends a lot of time thinking about where and how people live, urban density versus suburban sprawl, things like that.
There's a 2008 article by Weber and Matthews who actually go through the various environmental costs involved with food production, particularly carbon dioxide emissions. And they found that there's about 8.9 tons of carbon dioxide per household per year from food consumption in the United States. Out of that 8.9 tons, only 0.4 tons, so about 5%, less than 5%, came from food delivery to you. And all agricultural transportation up and down the food chain, that delivers only about 1 ton of carbon dioxide per household annually. So there's a lot of carbon emissions involved in food, but you want to think about it as being in the very heart of the food production, which is going to go on wherever you eat it or not. And there you're going to, you know, you will make choices about what you're eating, and obviously animals tend to be more energy intensive than grains, for example. Those choices are going to matter a lot more as to whether or not the food is shipped long distances, because it just doesn't require that much energy to ship food fairly long distances in this world.
So in keeping with that argument, the idea is that a bigger farm, whether it's a sheep farm or a produce farm, is going to be more efficient in its production per pound of food, let's say, than a smaller local farm, and that the transportation is just not a big enough piece of the equation to really tip the scale?
That's the usual argument, and I find it fairly compelling. The second argument that's made, and this has been particularly done comparing food production in England with other areas, so English researchers for some reason have been particularly aggressive on this, but food production in the UK, and I think it must be the same thing in New England, for our climate isn't that different, finds that the greenhouse gas emissions involved in eating English tomatoes are about 3 times as high as eating Spanish tomatoes, because you require hothouses to grow these things, and you know that you just have a better climate for food production. So at the heart of economics, right, is this notion of comparative advantage. And you know, think about David Ricardo 200 years ago talking about what a great thing it is that the English could export textiles and import wine from Portugal. When you're giving up on the global system of trade, you're giving up all of that. And that's not just about economic productivity. It's also about energy intensivity, because the places that are naturally productive at growing food are also places that you can do it with less artificial energy, with less artificial water, and so forth.
Now, let's say I believe you, and I have no reason not to believe you. In fact, I do believe you. But it seems as though there's a certain – maybe it's a pretty small quadrant of our population, but they're pretty noisy – who just seem to make a very compelling argument that it's just a bad idea to live in a world where we're shipping food from across the planet to eat here, that we should be better than that. Maybe, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is I hear your economist argument, but then I think, you know, from my personal moral perspective, like, I don't want to do that. I don't like the idea. I don't like the idea of a big sheep farm in New Zealand or a big grape produce farm in Chile bundling up all these tons and tons and tons of stuff, putting on a big ship, getting all the way over to me, and then it trucks to my supermarket or my market and I buy it there. I just don't – I hate that idea. Why is there more hatred for food and the complexity of the production and transportation of food than there is for, let's say, a T-shirt or an iPad?
Well, food is so personal, right? I mean, it is our most basic of needs, right? And the idea of something wrong being with our food cuts the very, you know, heart of our stomachs, of our souls almost. So it's not surprising that people have these deep emotional reactions to food. And we certainly are right to worry a lot about whether or not our food is fresh and good and tasty. But I just keep coming back to feeling a certain amount of satisfaction that I'm eating grapes that are keeping up the standard of living in Chile. So,
let me ask you this, Ed. You wrote a little bit about Michelle Obama's garden at the White House and her mm-hmm. pretty constant efforts to talk about the value of nutrition generally but also local agriculture. And you wrote this, if the First Lady wants to help the environment, she should campaign for high-rise apartments rather than plant vegetables. Ouch, first of all, but explain.
Well, I certainly meant no disrespect for the First Lady. But local gardens are unlikely to be any particularly great environmental benefit. And one way to think about this is it really is much more energy efficient to move food rather than moving people. Anytime we put space between us as human beings, we are increasing our own difficulties in transportation. Anytime we build at lower densities, we're meaning that we are driving longer distances. And that's a tremendous potential environmental cost, whereas moving the food around is just a very, very small cost relative to that. So I think really if we want to be focused on how we live and how it impacts our environmental footprints, we really do want to be thinking about how is it that we bring ourselves together, how is it that we eliminate space between us, not how is it that we insert extra space that are buffers between humanity.
So would your view of Michelle Obama's position on local agriculture be that, well, it's mostly benign, she's preaching that people should have more kind of local gardens and they may or they may not, and it really doesn't make that much of a difference? Or is your view of her stance that it's actually not a good stance because it may be counterproductive, as it kind of steals mind share for what would be smarter ideas for how to be more efficient and effective for more people?
I think it's basically benign. But the truth of the matter is I think she's really just pushing for greater awareness of food and greater attention to nutrition. And that's basically benign. What I do wish is I do wish both her and the president would actually start talking about the virtues of urban America. I mean, in some sense, President Obama is the most urban president we've had since Teddy Roosevelt. And yet we've heard very little about how critical America's cities are to our future. I mean, the fact that the three largest metropolitan areas in this country produce 18% of our GDP, while including only 13% of our population. And they're also important environmentally. So it's more sort of a frustration that it's fine for her to grow gardens. But I would love it if we just heard a strong message about what a great thing living in dense areas, living in high-rise apartments can also be for the environment. And indeed, we're far more likely to get significant environmental benefits from those than we are from eating locally or from urban gardens.
At the Union Square Green Market in the heart of New York City, the idea of buying local is pretty much gospel. I asked a few people, shoppers and vendors, to wrap their heads around the notion that going local isn't saving the world.
I would find that really hard to believe.
I may not 100% be able to argue against that, but what I will argue for is why not buy it if it is grown nearby?
And for me, smaller is better. For me, local is better.
The responses were interesting and diverse. Some denial, some rationalization, some switching over to the other ways in which local food is superior, like it tastes better. When you make decisions about something as important as the environment and as personal, as emotionally charged as food, it's hard to hear that the factual foundation of your decision is a bit wobbly. It can be easier just to stick to your beliefs, your intuitive beliefs, than it is to deal with the weird complexities of the modern world. But here's one piece of good news. That research paper by Christopher Weber about food miles, it didn't stop there.
There are a few types of food that are very greenhouse gas intensive, per calorie, per kilogram, per whatever, however you want to measure them. And red meat and dairy are especially bad players here. And if you are the average consumer, and again, we were always looking at the average consumer, one of the big, take-home messages that we tried to get out to people is that you can do more for your carbon footprint by just cutting those two things out of your diet for one day a week than you can by buying every single thing locally all the time.
So there you go. If you really want to help the environment, lay off cow products. The cow is particularly greenhouse gas intensive in part because, like all ruminants, it naturally emits methane. It's manure, it's exhalation, it's farts. And methane is more than 20 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. What's that you say? You can't imagine cutting back on burgers? Well, perhaps you'd consider a substitute. The kangaroo, for instance, doesn't emit methane. It's meat, a little rubbery, but tasty. So if you really want to help, what you've got to do is learn to love the roux.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions.
WHFR, Dearborn.
This is the story of a stove.
An energy-saving stove made in Uganda.
When Child Fund worked with local youth to make and sell these stoves, well, things really heated up.
Because these stoves use very little wood and produce less smoke.
Reducing deforestation and respiratory disease.
They're creating jobs and a brighter future.
This is only one of Child Fund's many innovative solutions benefiting children in need worldwide.
To learn more, visit childfund.org.
Child Fund. Innovative solutions, one child at a time.
I look around and no one was inside. Footsteps in the fog, hanging echoes in the dark. A window rattled somewhere in this long forgotten street. Don't know where it came from, but I sure could feel the heat.